at the stuffing. Pick, 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 pulling it out of the chair. While listening to proposals to spend money, said one article, and a lot of must-do projects just melted away. Well, like everything, we have to look at the comparisons. Across the street at Bank of America, executives also faced deregulation and recognized the need to eliminate waste. However, unlike Wells Fargo, Bank of America executives didn't have the discipline to rinse their own cottage cheese. Their approach seemed to be, we're going to eat all the fatty cottage cheese we want while all of our people rinse their cottage cheese. They preserved their posh executive kingdom in its imposing tower in downtown San Francisco. The CEO's office, described in the book Breaking the Bank, as a northeast corner suite with a large attached conference room, oriental rugs, and floor-to-ceiling windows that offered a sweeping panorama of the San Francisco Bay from the Golden Gate to the Bay Bridge. We found no evidence of executive chairs in the Bank of America executive suite with the stuffing hanging out. The elevator made its last stop at the executive floor and descended all the way to the ground in one quiet whoosh, unfettered by the intrusions of lesser beings. The vast open space in the executive suite made the windows look even taller than they actually were, creating a sense of floating above the fog in an elevated city of alien elites who ruled the world from above. Why rinse our cottage cheese when life is so good? After losing $1.8 billion across 3 years in the mid-1980s, Bank of America eventually made the necessary changes in response to deregulation, largely, as we mentioned earlier, by hiring ex-Wells Fargo executives. But even in the darkest days, B of A could not bring itself to get rid of the perks that sheltered its executives from the real world. At one board meeting during B of A's crisis period, one member made sensible suggestions like sell the corporate jet. Other directors listened to the recommendations, then passed them by. A culture, not a tyrant. We almost didn't include this chapter in the book. On the one hand, the good to great companies became more disciplined than the direct comparison companies, as with Wells Fargo in contrast to Bank of America. But the unsustained comparisons, these were the ones that went from good to great and then lost it quickly, showed themselves to be just as disciplined as the good to great companies. Based on my analysis, I don't think we can put discipline in the book as a finding, said Eric Hagen, after he completed a special analysis unit looking at the leadership cultures across the companies. It's absolutely clear that the unsustained comparison CEOs brought tremendous discipline to their companies, and that is why they got such great initial results. So discipline just doesn't pass muster as a distinguishing variable. Curious, we decided to look further into the issue, and Eric undertook a more in-depth analysis. As we examined the evidence, it became clear that, despite surface appearances, there was indeed a huge difference between the two sets of companies in their approach to discipline, a huge difference between the good-to-great companies and the unsustained comparisons. Whereas the good-to-great companies had level 5 leaders who built a culture of discipline, the unsustained comparisons had level 4 leaders who personally disciplined the organization through sheer force. Consider Ray McDonald, who took command, and that's the best word for it, command of Burroughs in 1964. A brilliant but abrasive man, McDonald controlled the conversation, told all the jokes, and criticized those not as smart as he, which was pretty much everyone around him. He got things done through sheer force of personality, using a form of pressure that came to be known as the McDonald vice. McDonald produced remarkable results during his reign. Every dollar invested in 1964, the year he became president, and taking out at the end of 1977 when he retired, produced returns 6.6 times better than the general market. However, the company had no culture no culture of discipline to endure beyond him. After he retired, his helper minions were frozen by indecision, leaving the company, according to Business Week, with an inability to do anything. Burroughs then began a long slide, with cumulative returns falling 93% below the market from the end of the McDonald era to 2000. We found a similar story at Rubbermaid under Stanley Galt. Think back to the Level 5 chapter and how Galt quipped in response to the accusation of being a tyrant, "Yes, but I'm a sincere tyrant." Galt brought strict disciplines to Rubbermaid. Rigorous planning and competitor analysis, systematic market research, profit analysis, hard-nosed cost control, and so on. "This is an incredibly disciplined organization," wrote one analyst. "There is an incredible thoroughness in Rubbermaid's approach to life." Precise and methodical, Galt arrived at work by 6:30 and routinely worked 80-hour work weeks, expecting his managers to do the same. As chief disciplinarian, Galt personally acted as the company's number one quality control mechanism. Walking down the street one day in Manhattan, he noticed a doorman muttering and swearing as he swept dirt into a Rubbermaid dustpan. "Stan whirled around and started grilling the man on why he was unhappy," said Richard Gates, who told the story to Fortune. Galt, convinced that the lip of the dustpan was too thick, promptly issued a diktat to his engineers to redesign the product. "On quality, I'm a son of a bitch," said Galt. His chief operating officer concurred. "He gets livid." Rubbermaid rose dramatically under the tyranny of this singularly disciplined leader. But then, just as dramatically, declined when he departed. Under Galt, Rubbermaid beat the market 3.6-1. After Galt, Rubbermaid lost 59% of its value relative to the market before being bought out by Newell. One particularly fascinating example of the disciplinarian syndrome was Lee Iacocca at Chrysler, whom Business Week described simply as the man, the dictator, Lee. Iacocca became president of Chrysler in 1979 and imposed his towering personality to discipline the organization into shape. "Right away, I knew the place was in a state of anarchy and needed a dose of order and discipline, and quick," wrote Iacocca of his early days. In his first year, he entirely overhauled the management structure, instituted strict financial controls, improved quality control measures, rationalized the production schedule, and conducted mass layoffs to preserve cash. "I felt like an army surgeon. We had to do radical surgery, saving what we could." In dealing with the unions, he said, "If you don't help me out, I'm going to blow your brains out. I'll declare bankruptcy in the morning and you're going to be out of work." Iacocca produced spectacular results, and Chrysler became one of the most celebrated turnarounds in industrial history. But then, about midway through his tenure, Iacocca seemed to lose focus, and the company began to decline once again. The Wall Street Journal wrote, "Mr. Iacocca headed the Statue of Liberty renovation, joined a congressional commission on budget reduction, and wrote a second book. He began a syndicated newspaper column, bought an Italian villa, where he started bottling his own wine and olive oil. Critics contend it all distracted him and was a root cause of Chrysler's current problems," continued the journal. "Distracting or not, it's clear that being a folk hero is a demanding sideline." Perhaps worse than his moonlight career as a national hero, his lack of discipline to stay within the arenas in which Chrysler could be the best in the world led to a binge of highly undisciplined diversifications. In 1985, he was lured into the sexy aerospace business. Whereas most CEOs would be content with a single Gulfstream jet, Iacocca decided to buy the whole Gulfstream company. Also in the mid-1980s, he embarked on a costly and ultimately unsuccessful joint venture with an Italian sports car maker. "Iacocca had a soft spot for Italians," said one retired Chrysler executive. Iacocca, who owns a modest estate in Tuscany, was so intent on an Italian alliance that commercial realities were ignored, wrote Businessweek. Some estimates put the loss of the failed Italian car venture at $200 million, which, according to Forbes, was an enormous sum to lose on a high-price, low-volume roadster. After all, no more than a few thousand will ever be built. During the first half of his tenure, Iacocca produced remarkable results, taking the company from near bankruptcy to nearly three times the general market. Impressive. During the second half of Iacocca's tenure, however, the company slid 31% behind the market and faced another potential bankruptcy. "Like so many patients with a heart condition," wrote Chrysler executive, "we'd survived surgery several years before only to revert to our unhealthy lifestyle." The above cases, Burroughs with Commander McDonald, and Rubbermaid with Stan Galt, and Iacocca at Chrysler, illustrate a pattern we found in every unsustained comparison. A spectacular rise under a tyrannical disciplinarian, followed by an equally spectacular decline when the disciplinarian stepped away, leaving behind no culture of discipline, or when the disciplinarian himself became undisciplined and strayed wantonly outside the three circles of the hedgehog concept. Yes, discipline is essential for great results, but disciplined action without disciplined understanding of the three circles cannot produce sustained great results. All of which brings us to the next point, fanatical adherence to the hedgehog concept. For nearly 40 years, Pitney Bowes lived inside the warm and protective cocoon of a monopoly. With its close relationship to the U.S. Postal Service and its patents on postage meter machines, Pitney attained 100% of the metered mail market. By the end of the 1950s, nearly half of all U.S. mail passed through Pitney Bowes machines. With gross profit margins in excess of 80%, no competition, a huge market, and a recession-proof business, Pitney Bowes wasn't so much a great company as a company with a great monopoly. Then, as almost always happens to monopolies when the protective cocoon is ripped away, Pitney Bowes began a long slide. First came a consent decree that required Pitney to license its patents to competitors, royalty-free. Within 6 years, Pitney Bowes had 16 competitors. Pitney then fell into a reactionary Chicken Little, the sky is falling diversification frenzy, throwing cash after ill-fated acquisitions and joint ventures, including a $70 million bloodbath, 54% of net stockholders' equity at the time, from a computer retail foray. In 1973, the company lost money for the first time in its entire history. It was shaping up to be just another typical case of a monopoly-protected company gradually falling apart once confronted with the harsh reality of competition. But that's not the way it turned out in the end. Fortunately for Pitney Bowes, a level 5 leader named Fred Allen stepped in and asked hard questions that led to deeper understanding of Pitney's role in the world. Instead of viewing itself as just a postage meter company, Pitney came to see that it could be the best in the world at serving the back rooms of businesses within the broader concept of messaging. It also came to see that sophisticated back-office products, like, say, high-end faxes and specialized copiers, played right into its economic engine of profit per customer, building off its extensive sales and service network. Allen and his successor, George Harvey, then instituted a model of disciplined diversification. For example, Pitney eventually attained 45% of the high-end fax market for large company, a hugely profitable cash machine. Harvey began a systematic process of investment in new technologies and products, such as the Paragon mail processor that seals and sends letters, and by the late 1980s, Pitney consistently derived over half its revenues from products introduced in the previous 3 years. Later, Pitney became a pioneer at linking backroom machines to the internet, yet another opportunity for disciplined diversification. The key point is not all the details of their business, but that at every step of diversification and innovation, they stayed within the three circles. The result? After falling 77% behind the market from the consent decree to its darkest days in 1973, Pitney Bowes then reversed course, eventually rising to over 11 times the market by the start of 1999. From 1973 to 2000, Pitney Bowes outperformed Coca-Cola, outperformed 3M, outperformed Johnson & Johnson, Merck, Motorola, Procter & Gamble, Hewlett-Packard, Walt Disney, and even General Electric. Can you think of any other company that emerged from the protective comfort of a monopoly cocoon to deliver this level of results? AT&T didn't. Xerox didn't. Even IBM didn't. Pitney Bowes illustrates what can happen when a company lacks the discipline to stay within the three circles, and conversely, what can happen when it regains that discipline. The good to great companies at their best followed a simple mantra. Anything that does not fit with our hedgehog concept, we will not do. We will not launch unrelated businesses. We will not make unrelated acquisitions. We will not do unrelated joint ventures. If it doesn't fit, we don't do it. Period. In contrast, we found a lack of discipline to stay within the three circles as a key factor in the demise of nearly all the comparison companies. Every comparison either, one, lacked the discipline to understand its three circles in the first place, or two, lacked the discipline to stay within the three circles even if it understood them. R.J. Reynolds is a classic case. Until the 1960s, R.J. Reynolds had a simple and clear concept built around being the best tobacco company in the United States, a position it had held for at least 25 years. Then in 1964, the Surgeon General issued his report that linked cigarettes with cancer, and R.J. Reynolds began to diversify away from tobacco as a defensive measure. Now, of course, all tobacco companies began to diversify at that time for the same reason, including the good-to-great company Philip Morris. But R.J. Reynolds' wanderings outside its three circles defied all logic. The company spent nearly a third of total corporate assets in 1970 to buy a shipping container company and an oil company, Sealand and Ammon Oil, the idea being to make money by shipping its own oil. Okay, not a terrible idea on its own, but what on earth did it have to do with R.J. Reynolds' hedgehog concept? It was a wholly undisciplined acquisition that came about in part because Sealand's founder was a close friend of R.J. Reynolds' chairman. After pouring more than $2 billion into Sealand, the total investment nearly equaled the entire amount of net stockholders' equity. Finally, after years of starving the tobacco business to funnel funds into the sinking ship business, RJR acknowledged failure and sold Sealand. One Reynolds' grandson complained, "Look, these guys are the world's best at making and selling tobacco products. But what do they know about ships or oil? I'm not worried about them going broke, but they look like country boys with too much cash in their pockets." To be fair, Philip Morris did not have a perfect diversification record either, as evidenced by its failed purchase of 7-Up, which we discussed earlier. However, in stark contrast to R.J. Reynolds, Philip Morris displayed greater discipline in response to the 1964 Surgeon General's report. Instead of abandoning its hedgehog concept and running around like Chicken Little, Philip Morris redefined its hedgehog concept in terms of building global brands in not-so-healthy consumables. Tobacco, beer, soft drinks, coffee, chocolate, cheese, etc. Philip Morris's superior discipline to stay within the three circles is one key reason why the results of the two companies diverged so dramatically after the 1964 report, despite the fact that they both faced the exact same industry opportunities and threats. From 1964 to 1989, when R.J. Reynolds disappeared from public trading in a leveraged buyout, $1 invested in Philip Morris beat $1 invested in R.J. Reynolds by over 4 times. Very few companies have the discipline to discover their hedgehog concept. Fewer still have the discipline to build consistently within it. They fail to grasp a simple paradox. The more an organization has the discipline to stay within its three circles, the more it will have attractive opportunities for growth. Indeed, to quote David Packard, founder of Hewlett-Packard Company, a great company is much more likely to die of indigestion of too much opportunity than starvation from too little. The challenge becomes not opportunity creation, but opportunity selection. It takes discipline to say no. No, thank you. No, not for us. No to big opportunities. The fact that something is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity is irrelevant if it doesn't fit within your three circles. If you're a great company, you will have many once-in-a-lifetime opportunities. That something is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity is a fact. It is not a reason. This notion of fanatical consistency relative to the hedgehog concept doesn't just concern the portfolio of strategic activities. It can also relate to the entire way you manage and build an organization. Nucor built its success around the hedgehog concept of harnessing culture and technology to produce steel. Central to Nucor's concept was the idea of aligning worker interests with management and shareholder interests in an egalitarian meritocracy largely devoid of class distinctions. Wrote Ken Iverson in his 1998 book, Plain Talk, inequality still runs rampant in most corporations. I'm referring now to the hierarchical inequality which legitimizes and institutionalizes the principle of we versus they. The people at the top of corporate hierarchy grant themselves privilege after privilege, flaunt those privileges before the men and women who do the real work, then wonder why employees are unmoved by management's invocations to cut costs and boost profitability. When I think of the millions of dollars spent by people at the top of the management hierarchy on efforts to motivate people who are continually put down by that hierarchy, I can only shake my head and wonder. When we interviewed Ken Iverson, he told us that nearly 100% of the success of Nucor was due to its ability to translate its simple concept into disciplined action consistent with that concept. Nucor grew into a $3.5 billion Fortune 500 company with only 4 layers of management and a corporate headquarters staff of fewer than 25 people, executive, financial, secretarial, the whole shebang, crammed into a rented office space the size of a small dental practice. Cheap veneer furniture adorned the lobby, which in itself was not much larger than a closet. Instead of a corporate dining room, executives hosted visiting dignitaries at Phil's Diner, a strip mall sandwich shop across the street. Nucor executives did not receive better benefits than frontline workers. In fact, executives had fewer perks. For example, all workers, but not executives, were eligible to receive $2,000 per year for each child, up to 4 years of post-high school education. In one incident, a man came to Marvin Pullman and said, "I have 9 kids. Are you telling me that you'll pay for 4 years of school, college, trade school, whatever, for every single one of my kids?" Pullman acknowledged that, yes, that's exactly what would happen. "The man just sat there and cried," said Pullman. "I'll never forget it. It just captures, in one moment, so much of what we were trying to do." When Nucor had a highly profitable year, everyone in the company would have a very profitable year. Nucor workers became so well paid that one woman told her husband, "You get fired from Nucor, I'll divorce you." But when Nucor faced difficult times, everyone from top to bottom suffered. But people at the top suffered more. In the 1982 recession, for example, worker pay went down 25%. Officer pay went down 60%. And the CEO's pay went down 75%. To further be consistent with its hedgehog concept, Nucor took extraordinary steps to keep at bay the class distinctions that eventually encroach on most organizations. All 7,000 employees' names appeared in the annual report, not just officers and executives. Just go back and revisit that for a moment. All 7,000 employees' names appeared in the annual report. Everyone except safety supervisors and visitors wore the same color hard hats. Now, the color of hard hats might sound trivial, but it caused quite a stir. Some foremen complained that special colored hard hats identified them as higher in the chain, an important status symbol that they could put on the back shelves of their cars or trucks. Nucor responded by organizing a series of forums to address the point that your status and authority at Nucor come from your leadership capabilities, not your position, and not from the color of your hard hat. If you don't like it, if you really feel you need that class distinction, well, then Nucor is just not the right place for you. To highlight how consistent and extreme, how much cottage cheese Nucor rinsed, let's contrast Nucor to another steel company, the comparison Bethlehem. In contrast to Nucor's dental suite-size headquarters, Bethlehem Steel built a 21-story office complex to house its executive staff. At extra expense, it designed the building more like a cross than a rectangle. And why would you do this? Well, it was a design that accommodated the large numbers of vice presidents who needed corner offices. The vice presidents had to have windows in two directions. So it was out of that desire that we came up with the design, explained a Bethlehem executive. In his book, Crisis in Bethlehem, John Strohmeyer details a culture as far to the other end of the continuum from Nucor as you could possibly imagine. He describes a fleet of corporate aircraft, used even for taking executives' children to college, and flitting away to weekend hideaways. He describes a world-class 18-hole executive golf course, an executive country club renovated with Bethlehem corporate funds, and even how executive rank determined shower priority at the club. We came to the conclusion, in fact, that Bethlehem executives saw the very purpose of their activities as the perpetuation of a class system that elevated them to elite status. Bethlehem did not decline in the 1970s and 80s primarily because of imports or technology. That's what everybody would think caused the decline, but no. Bethlehem declined first and foremost because it was a culture wherein people focused their efforts on negotiating the nuances of an intricate social hierarchy, rather than focusing on customers, competitors, or changes in the external world. From 1966, at the start of its buildup, to 1999, Nucor posted 34 consecutive years of positive profitability. While over those same 34 years, Bethlehem Steel lost money 12 times, and its total cumulative profitability added up to less than zero. Total net income over 34 years, if you added up every year of profits, was less than zero. By the 1990s, Nucor's profitability beat Bethlehem's every single year. And at the end of the century, Nucor, which had been less than a third the size of Bethlehem only a decade earlier, finally surpassed Bethlehem in total revenues. Even more astounding, Nucor's average 5-year profit per employee exceeded Bethlehem by almost 10 times. And for the investor, $1 invested in Nucor beat $1 invested in Bethlehem Steel by over 200 times. To be fair, Bethlehem had one giant problem not faced by Nucor. adversarial labor relations, and entrenched unions. Nucor had no union, and enjoyed remarkably good relations with its workers. In fact, when union organizers visited one plant, workers felt so ferociously loyal to Nucor that management had to protect the union organizers from workers who began shouting and throwing sand at them. But the union argument begs a crucial question. Why did Nucor have such a better relationship with its workers in the first place? Why? Because Ken Iverson and his team had a simple crystalline hedgehog concept. And that hedgehog concept was about aligning worker interests with management interests. And most important, because they were willing to go to almost extreme lengths to build the entire enterprise consistent with that concept, they rinsed their cottage cheese. Call them a bit fanatical if you want. But to create great results requires a nearly fanatical dedication to the idea of consistency, super consistency, with the hedgehog concept. The stop doing list. Do you have a to-do list? Most of us do. I imagine you do. Now, do you also have a stop doing list? Most of us lead busy but undisciplined lives. We have ever-expanding to-do lists, trying to build momentum by doing, 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 and then doing more. It rarely works. Those who built the good-to-great companies, however, made as much use of stop-doing lists. They displayed a remarkable discipline to unplug all sorts of extraneous junk. When Darwin Smith became CEO of Kimberly-Clark, he made great use of stop-doing lists. He saw that playing the annual forecast game with Wall Street focused people too much on the short term, so he just stopped doing it. On balance, I see no net advantage to our stockholders when we annually forecast future earnings, said Smith. We will not do it. He saw title creep as a sign of class consciousness and bureaucratic layering. So he simply unplugged titles. No one at the company would have a title, unless it was for a position where the outside world demanded a title. He saw increasing layers as the natural result of empire building. So he simply unplugged a huge stack of layers with a simple, elegant mechanism. If you couldn't justify to your peers the need for at least 15 people reporting to you to fulfill your responsibilities, then you would have zero people reporting to you. Keep in mind, he did this in the 1970s, long before such actions became fashionable. To reinforce the idea that Kimberly-Clark should begin thinking of itself as a consumer company, not a paper company, he unplugged Kimberly from all paper industry trade associations. The Good to Great companies institutionalized the discipline of stop doing through the use of a unique budget mechanism. Now stop and think about this for a minute. What's the purpose of having a budget? Most answer that budgeting exists to decide how much to apportion to each activity, or to manage costs, or both. From a good to great perspective, both of these answers are wrong. In a good to great transformation, budgeting is a discipline of a peculiar type, a discipline to decide which arenas should be fully funded, and which should not be funded at all. In other words, the budget process is not about figuring out how much each activity gets, but about determining which activities best support the hedgehog concept, and should be fully strengthened, and which should be eliminated entirely. Go back to Darwin Smith selling the mills. Kimberly-Clark didn't just reallocate resources from the paper business to the consumer business. It completely eliminated the paper business, sold the mills, and invested all the money into the emerging consumer business. I had an interesting conversation with some executives from a company in the paper business. It's a good company, not yet a great one. And they had competed at one point directly with Kimberly-Clark before Kimberly transformed itself into a consumer company. Out of curiosity, I asked what they thought of Kimberly-Clark. They looked at me and then said, What Kimberly did is not fair.
Not fair?
I looked quizzical. Oh, sure. They've become a much more successful company. But you know, if we'd sold our paper business and become a powerful consumer company, we could have been great too. But we just have too much invested in it, and we couldn't have brought ourselves to do it. If you look back at the good to great companies, they displayed remarkable courage to channel their resources into only one or a few arenas. Once they understood their three circles, they rarely hedged their bets. Recall Kroger's commitment to overturn its entire system to create superstores, while A&P clung to the safety of its older stores. Recall Abbott's commitment to put the bulk of its resources into becoming number one in diagnostics and hospital nutritionals, while Upjohn clung to the safety of its core pharmaceutical business, where, unfortunately, it could never be the best in the world. Recall how Walgreens exited the profitable food service business and focused all its might into one idea, the best, most convenient drugstores. Recall Gillette and Sensor, Nucor and the Mini Mills, Kimberly-Clark and Selling the Mills to channel all its resources into the consumer business. They all had the guts to make huge investments once they understood their hedgehog concept. The most effective investment strategy is a highly undiversified portfolio where you are right. As facetious as that sounds, that's essentially the approach the good to great companies took. Being right means getting the hedgehog concept. Highly undiversified means investing fully in those things that fit squarely within the three circles and getting rid of everything else. Of course, the key here is a little caveat. When you are right. But how do you know when you are right? In studying the companies, we learned that being right just isn't that hard if you have all the pieces in place. If you have level 5 leaders who get the right people on the bus. If you confront the brutal facts of reality. If you create a climate where the truth is heard. If you have a council. If you work within the three circles. If you frame all decisions in the context of a crystalline hedgehog concept, if you act from understanding, not bravado, if you do all of these things, then you are likely to be right on the big decisions. The real question is, once you know the right thing, do you have the discipline to do the right thing? And equally important, to stop doing the wrong things. Chapter Summary, A Culture of Discipline. Sustained great results depend upon building a culture full of self-disciplined people who take disciplined action, fanatically consistent with the three circles of the hedgehog concept. Bureaucratic cultures arise to compensate for incompetence and lack of discipline, which arise from having the wrong people on the bus in the first place. If you get the right people on the bus and the wrong people off the bus, you don't need stultifying bureaucracy. A culture of discipline involves a duality. On the one hand, it requires people who adhere to a consistent system. Yet, on the other hand, it gives people freedom and responsibility within the framework of that system. A culture of discipline is not just about action. It is about getting disciplined people who engage in disciplined thought and who then take disciplined action. The good to great companies appear boring and pedestrian looking in from the outside, but upon closer inspection, they're full of people who display extreme diligence and a stunning intensity. They rinse their cottage cheese. Do not confuse a culture of discipline with a tyrant who disciplines. They are very different concepts. One highly functional, the culture of discipline. The other highly dysfunctional, the tyrannical disciplinarian. Save your CEOs who personally discipline through sheer force of personality usually fail to produce sustained results. The single most important discipline for sustained results is fanatical adherence to the hedgehog concept and the willingness to shun opportunities that fall outside the three circles. A few unexpected findings. The more an organization has the discipline to stay within its three circles with almost religious consistency, the more it will have opportunities for growth. The fact that something is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity is irrelevant. It's irrelevant unless it fits within the three circles. A great company will have many once-in-a-lifetime opportunities. Another form of Packard's Law. A great company is more likely to die of indigestion of too much opportunity than starvation from too little. The purpose of budgeting in a good-to-great company is not to decide how much each activity gets, but to decide which arenas best fit with the hedgehog concept and should be fully funded, and which should not be funded at all. And finally, my personal favorite from the whole chapter, stop doing lists are more important than to-do lists. I will leave it up to you to resolve the existential dilemma about whether to put start a stop doing list on your to-do list. Chapter 7, Technology Accelerators. Most men would rather die than think. Many do. Bertrand Russell. On July 28, 1999, drugstore.com, one of the first internet pharmacies, sold shares of its stock to the public. Within seconds of the opening bell, the stock multiplied nearly threefold to $65 a share. 4 weeks later, the stock closed as high as $69, creating a market valuation of over $3.5 billion. Not bad for an enterprise that had sold products for less than 9 months, had fewer than 500 employees, offered no hope of investor dividends for years, if not decades, and deliberately planned to lose hundreds of millions of dollars before turning a single dollar of profit. What rationale did people use to justify these rather extraordinary numbers? New technology will change everything, the logic went. The internet is going to completely revolutionize all businesses, the gurus chanted. It's the great internet land grab. Be there first, be there fast, build market share, no matter how expensive, and you win, yelled the entrepreneurs. We entered a remarkable moment in history when the whole idea of trying to build a great company seemed, well, quaint and outdated. Built to flip rather than built to last became the mantra of the day. Just tell people you were doing something, anything, connected with the internet, and presto, you became rich by flipping shares to the public, even if you had no profits or even a real company. Why take all the hard steps to go from build-up to breakthrough, creating a model that actually works when you could yell, new technology, or yell, new economy, and convince people to give you hundreds of millions of dollars? Some entrepreneurs didn't even bother to suggest that they would build a real company at all, much less a great one. One even filed to go public in March of 2000 with an enterprise that consisted solely of an informational website and a business plan. Nothing more. The entrepreneur admitted to the industry standard that it seemed strange to go public before starting a business, but that didn't stop him from trying to persuade investors to buy 1.1 million shares at $7 to $9 per share, despite having no revenues, no employees, no customers, no company. With the new technology of the internet, who needs all those archaic relics of the old economy? Or so the logic of the times went. At the high point of this frenzy, drugstore.com issued its challenge to Walgreens. At first, Walgreens stock suffered from the invasion of the dot-coms, losing over 40% of its price in the months leading up to the drugstore.com public offering. Wrote Forbes magazine in October 1999, investors seem to think that the web race will be won by competitors who hit the ground running. Companies like drugstore.com, which trades at 398 times revenue, That's not 398 times profits, because there were no profits. 398 times revenue, rather than Walgreen, trading at 1.4 times revenue. Analysts downgraded Walgreen's stock, and the pressure on Walgreens to react to the internet threat increased as nearly $15 billion in market value evaporated. Walgreens' response in the midst of this frenzy? "We're a crawl, walk, run company," Dan Jornt told Forbes in describing his deliberate, methodical approach to the internet. Instead of reacting like Chicken Little, Walgreens executives did something quite unusual for the time. They decided to pause and reflect. They decided to use their brains. They decided to think. Slow at first, crawl, Walgreens began experimenting with a website while engaging in intense internal dialogue and debate about its implications, within the context of its own peculiar hedgehog. How will the internet connect to our convenience concept? How can we tie it to our economic denominator of profit per customer visit? How can we use the web to enhance what we do better than any other company in the world, and in a way that we're passionate about? Throughout, Walgreens executives embrace the Stockdale paradox. We have complete faith that we can prevail in an internet world as a great company. Yet, we must also confront the brutal facts of reality about the internet. One Walgreens executive told us a fun little story about this remarkable moment in history. An internet leader made a statement about Walgreens along the lines of, "Oh, Walgreens. They're too old and stodgy for the internet world. They'll be left behind." The Walgreens people, while irked by this arrogant comment from the internet elite, never seriously considered a public response. Said one executive, "Let's quietly go about doing what we need to do, and it'll become clear soon enough that they just pulled the tail of the wrong dog." Then a little faster, walk. Walgreens began to find ways to tie the internet directly to its sophisticated inventory and distribution model and ultimately its convenience concept. Fill your prescription online, pop into your car, and go to your local Walgreens drive-thru in whatever city you happen to be in at the moment. Zoom past the window with hardly a moment's pause, picking up your bottle of, well, whatever. Or have it shipped to you if that's more convenient. There was no manic lurching about, no hype, no bravado. Just calm, deliberate, pursuit of understanding, followed by calm, deliberate steps forward. Then finally, run. Walgreens bet big, launching an internet site as sophisticated and well-designed as most pure dot-coms. Just before writing this chapter in October of 2000, we went online to use Walgreens.com. We found it as easy to use, and the system of delivery largely as reliable and well thought out as Amazon.com, which was then the reigning champion of e-commerce. Precisely 1 year after the Forbes article, Walgreens had figured out how to harness the internet to accelerate momentum, making it just that much more unstoppable. It announced, on its website in fact, a significant increase in job openings to support its sustained growth. From its low point in 1999 at the depths of the dot-com scare, Walgreens stock nearly doubled within a year. And what of drugstore.com? Continuing to accumulate massive losses, it announced a layoff to conserve cash. At its high point, little more than a year earlier, drugstore.com traded at a price 26 times higher than at the time of this writing. It had lost nearly all of its initial value. While Walgreens went from crawl to walk to run, drugstore.com went from run to walk to crawl. Perhaps drugstore.com will figure out a sustainable model that works and become a great company, but it will not become great because of snazzy technology, internet hype, and an irrational stock market. It will only become a great company if it figures out how to apply technology to a coherent concept that reflects understanding of the three circles of a hedgehog concept. Now you might be thinking, but the internet frenzy is just a speculative bubble that burst. So what? Everyone knew that the bubble was unsustainable, that it just couldn't last. What does that teach us about good to great? To be clear, The point of this chapter has little to do with the specifics of the internet bubble per se. Bubbles come and bubbles go. It happened with the railroads. It happened with electricity. It happened with the radio. It happened with the personal computer. It happened with the internet. And it will happen again with unforeseen new technologies. Yet, throughout all of this change, great companies have adapted and endured. Indeed, most of the truly great companies of the last 100 years, from Walmart to Walgreens, from Procter & Gamble to Kimberly-Clark, from Merck to Abbott, trace their roots back through multiple generations of technology change, be it electricity, the television, or the internet. They've adapted before and emerged great. The best ones will adapt again. Technology-induced change, it's nothing new. The real question is not, what is the role of technology? Rather, the real question is, how do good to great organizations think differently about technology? Not what do they do, but what do they think? We could have predicted that Walgreens would eventually figure out the internet. The company had a history of making huge investments in technology long before other companies in its industry. In the early 1980s, it pioneered a massive network system called Intercom. The idea was simple. By linking all Walgreens stores electronically and sending customer data to a central source, it turned every Walgreens outlet in the country into a customer's local pharmacy. You live in Florida, but you're visiting Phoenix. You need to get a prescription refill. No problem. The Phoenix store is linked to the central system, and it's just like going down to your hometown Walgreens store. This might seem mundane by today's standards, but when Walgreens made the investment in Intercom in the late 1970s, no one else in the industry had anything like it. Eventually, Walgreens invested over $400 million in Intercom, including $100 million for its own satellite system. Touring the Intercom headquarters, dubbed Earth Station Walgreen, is like taking a trip through a NASA space center with its stunning array of sophisticated electronic gadgetry, wrote a trade journal. Walgreen's technical staff became skilled at maintaining every piece of technology rather than relying on outside specialists. And it didn't stop there. Walgreens pioneered the application of scanners, robotics, computerized inventory control, and advanced warehouse tracking systems. The internet, it's just one more step in a continuous pattern. Walgreens didn't adopt all of this advanced technology just for the sake of advanced technology or in fearful reaction to falling behind. No, it used technology as a tool to accelerate momentum after hitting breakthrough and tied technology directly to its hedgehog concept of convenient drugstores increasing profit per customer visit. As an interesting aside, as technology became increasingly sophisticated in the late 1990s, Walgreens CIO, Chief Information Officer, was a registered pharmacist by training, not a technology guru. Walgreens remained resolutely clear. Its hedgehog concept would drive its use of technology, not the other way around. The Walgreens case reflects a general pattern. In every good to great case, we did find technological sophistication. However, it was never technology per se, but the pioneering application of carefully selected technologies. Every good to great company became a pioneer in the application of technology, but the technologies themselves varied greatly. On page 150 of the hardcover edition of Good to Great, I have listed all of the pioneering applications of technologies that stand out in each of the Good to Great companies. Kroger, for example, was an early pioneer in the application of barcode scanners, which helped it accelerate past A&P by linking frontline purchases to backroom inventory management. This might not sound very exciting. Inventory management is not something that tends to rivet readers. But think of it this way. Imagine walking back into the warehouse, and instead of seeing boxes of cereal and crates of apples, you see stacks and stacks of dollar bills. Hundreds of thousands and millions of freshly minted, crisp and crinkly dollar bills just sitting there on pallets, piled high to the ceiling. That's how you should think of inventory. Every single case of canned carrots is not just a case of canned carrots. It's cash. And it's cash just sitting there useless until you sell that case of canned carrots. Now recall how Kroger systematically shed its dreary old and small grocery stores, replacing them with nice, big, shiny superstores. To get this done required more than $9 billion of investment. Cash. $9 billion of cash that would somehow have to be pulled out of the low-margin grocery business. To put this in perspective, Kroger put more than twice its annual profits into capital expenditures on average every year for 30 years. Even more impressive, despite taking on $5.5 billion of junk bond debt to pay a one-time $40 per share cash dividend, plus an $8 debenture to fight off corporate raiders in 1988, Kroger continued its cash-intensive revamping throughout the 1980s and 1990s. Kroger modernized and turned over all its stores, improved the customer shopping experience, radically expanded the variety of products offered, and paid off billions of dollars in debt. Kroger's use of scanning technology to take hundreds of millions of crisp and crinkly dollar bills out of the warehouse and put them to better use became a key element in its ability to pull off its magic trick, pulling not one, not two, but three rabbits out of a hat. Gillette also became a pioneer in the application of technology. But Gillette's technology accelerators lay largely in manufacturing technology. Think about the technology required to make billions, literally billions, of low-cost, high-tolerance razor blades. When you and I pick up a Gillette razor, we expect the blade to be perfect, and we expect it to be inexpensive. For example, to create the sensor, Gillette invested over $200 million in design and development, most of it focused on manufacturing breakthroughs, and earned 29 patents. It pioneered the application of laser welding on a mass scale to shaving systems. It's a technology normally used for expensive and sophisticated products like heart pacemakers. The whole key to Gillette's shaving systems lay in manufacturing technology so unique, so proprietary that Gillette protected it the way Coca-Cola protects its secret formula, complete with armed guards and security clearances. Technology as an accelerator, not a creator of momentum. When Jim Johnson became chief executive of Fannie Mae following David Maxwell, he and his leadership team hired a consulting firm to conduct a technology audit. The lead consultant, Bill Kelvey, used a four-level ranking, with four being cutting edge and one being stone age. Fannie Mae ranked only a two. So following the principle of first who, Kelvey was hired to move the company ahead. When Kelvey came to Fannie Mae in 1990, the company lagged about 10 years behind Wall Street in the use of technology. Over the next 5 years, Kelvey systematically took Fannie Mae from a 2 to a 3.8 on the 4-point ranking. He and his team created over 300 computer applications, including sophisticated analytical programs to control the $600 billion mortgage portfolio, online data warehouses covering 60 million properties, and streamlined workflows, significantly reducing paper and clerical effort. We moved technology out of the back office and harnessed it to transform every part of the business, said Kelvey. We created an expert system that lowers the cost of becoming a homeowner. Lenders using our technology reduced the loan approval time from 30 days to 30 minutes and lowered the associated cost by over $1,000 per loan. To date, when we wrote the book in year 2000, the system had saved homebuyers nearly $4 billion. Notice something. The Fannie Mae transition began in 1981 with the arrival of David Maxwell. Yet, the company lagged behind in the application of technology until the early 1990s, a decade later. Yes, technology became